Beer, 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 beer. Today we're talking a little bit about beer. More specifically, we're talking Stone Brewing, which opened in 2016, just minutes away from Richmond's downtown. Hey everybody, I'm Blaine Lay, and you're listening to Two People. It's a show where we talk to folks from around town about their personal experience and how that comes to life publicly in the work they do. Today on the show, I sit down with Julie Ellen Sarver, Community Relations Manager at Stone. And Julie Ellen has lived in Fulton for years. She's got a garden, she rides her bike, she's been involved in the community. I think she's got a dog, I'm not sure. But she's lived there in Fulton for years before she actually started working at Stone. And Julie Ellen sheds some light on the history of the neighborhood, how Stone decided on Richmond, and how the community got engaged with Stone along the way. We also talk about the economic development deal behind Stone. We talk Stone's partnership with other breweries in town. And we also hear a bit about what we can expect from the new bistro that's underway. It's going to be right on the river. Between you and me, that thing is going to be great. So yeah, you get to meet a cool lady. You get to hear about all the beer things. This is episode 29 with Julie Ellen Sarver. This is Two People.
Are we rolling? We are rolling.
All right. Julie Ellen Sarver, thank you so much for being here on the show.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you making the time for us. You are the Community Relations Manager over at Stone. Can you just talk a little bit about what that means in your day-to-day and what your role is?
Sure. I wear a lot of hats over there. I think originally my main tasks were to be to maintain relations with the residents of the Greater Fulton neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Greater Fulton, which is historic Fulton, which is the old Fulton, which is actually new. It's very confusing. It was the original Fulton neighborhood that was raised during the 1970s, during urban renewal. So it's that neighborhood.
And that's kind of Fulton Bottom.
Right. When we don't call it Fulton Bottom anymore.
Okay.
The former residents who are still around believe, and rightly so, that the term bottom is derogatory.
Hmm.
So we call it Fulton or historic Fulton. And so Greater Fulton is the Fulton, Fulton Hill, which is up on the hill, and Montrose Heights, which is the next hill across from government, across government road.
And this is all, for those that may be new to Richmond and might not even know where we're talking about, this is all east of town. So if you take Broad Street going east, you drive through the city, you go down up through Church Hill and keep on going.
Keep on going past Church Hill. The city does not end at Church Hill.
Right.
Which a lot of people, even people who have lived in the city for a while, just assumed that east of Church Hill became in eastern Henrico. But now the city keeps going on.
Yeah.
For a little bit longer.
Come on down and visit Greater Fulton.
That's right. Greater Fulton. Place to be. It used to be called Richmond's best kept secret. By residents who live there, and it's kind of not a secret anymore.
Mm-hmm. It's on the up and up, Greater Fulton.
It's coming along, yeah.
And your expertise is in city planning and landscape design.
Yeah.
How did that come about? What is it about cities and landscapes that drew you to that course of study?
Oh, I've always been into cities. Ever since I was a child, I lived in Boston, Cambridge, Massachusetts, till I was 12, and was this little independent city kid, 9 years old, getting on the T by myself, going to ballet. Cities are a wonderful place to be independent as a child, and I was grateful that I was allowed that freedom. When I was 12, I moved to the country in North Carolina, and that was a big shock. But it was okay. It was different, but I had to be driven everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always loved cities and have been drawn to them. Boston, and I lived in Paris for a little while, Washington, D.C. for a number of years. And I just love the vibrancy and the diversity. And in D.C., you know, I'd hear a bunch of different languages.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't need a car up there. It was really great. My father's a city planner and an architect, and I originally had wanted to be an architect, was in architecture school for a year and realized that the math part was just not going to work.
So would you guys, with your dad as a city planner, would you guys grow up, did you talk about cities
or
over the dinner table?
Yeah, I think we did. And in, as an undergraduate, there was no city planning undergraduate degree where I went to college. So, but there were, there was a graduate program. So I was able to take, I think, two programs in that graduate school,
this
two classes.
In North Carolina?
Yeah, University of North Carolina, okay. Chapel Hill. And then actually went to graduate school in landscape architecture at North Carolina State University. And once I got into that program, a professor, the head of the department of UNC's city planning school, graduate school, contacted me and said, hey, we're thinking of doing this joint degree program. Would you like to be our guinea pig? So I said, sure. So I ended up doing a joint master's degree program in city planning at UNC and in landscape architecture at NC State. It took 4 years for two masters, which would have taken five if they were consecutive. And only once did I go the wrong way out of my driveway to go to one school or the other because I lived in the middle.
That's awesome.
So that was turned out to be a really interesting program to pursue.
Yeah, I mean, you were well educated in all of the city things here.
All the city things. And then I moved to Paris for a short time, couldn't find a job, so I moved back to the States and worked in North Carolina doing affordable housing development. And then I moved to Washington, D.C. and was worked in two pretty well-known city planning and urban design landscape architecture firms.
And when did you move to Richmond and what brought you here to town? Why Richmond?
I moved to Richmond in 2007. I had been living in Washington, D.C. for 6 years and had one of those life changes that makes you move. So I wasn't sure where I'd wanted to go. And I decided on Richmond because over the years, I had determined what makes a great city, and number one is a river, university, good architecture. For me, it's important to be on a coast. I'm not an interior of the country person. I need to have my access to the water, and relatively affordable, and Richmond hit all those points. It also has a good climate. So I didn't know anyone here, and I just moved. And it was like going halfway home to North Carolina, but I could still go to D.C. for lunch if I wanted to.
Right. Yeah, it's equidistant between the two.
Yeah.
And did you know that Fulton is what it is? How did you select neighborhoods? Did you look around?
Yeah,
or did you just stumble on Fulton?
I didn't know Richmond at all.
Because you live in Greater Fulton as well, right?
I do. I live in Montrose Heights, and I bought my house there in 2008, so for a year... The first year I lived here, I rented an apartment at Tobacco Row in Chaco Bottom and got to know the city and decided I want to buy a place and had a great realtor, Andrea Levine, and she introduced me to Fulton. She said it's got great, really neat creative community. There's artists. It's kind of hidden. It's out of the way. A big factor for me is I'm a bicyclist, and it was before the Capitol Trail was finished, but I could ride my bike from my house without having to get into a car and be out in Vrina, Eastern Henrico Roads, in 10 minutes. So that was a big reason.
You can get into the city, or you can get out to the cornfields. It's not far.
And also, I'm a little bit anti-establishment, and I tend to do things that are not expected. So, I could have gotten a condo in the Fan, but that would have been boring, right? So I did things a little differently. But I got this great little 1930s house with a yard for my garden. I ended up getting a dog, which I'd always wanted, never had, because I had a yard. So it's worked out great. And then Stone comes along much later, and everything kind of works out.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about that, because I think your journey is interesting and that you were in Fulton for a while as a resident. You were involved, you were engaged, and it wasn't until later that Stone came on the radar, and then you eventually got a job there. But could you just talk a little bit about how you were involved in the neighborhood, how Stone came to be, and just your involvement in that?
Well, since I moved to Richmond and didn't know anybody and was working at that time as a consultant from home, but all my projects were in North Carolina, I needed to get out and meet people. Mm-hmm. So,
which is always good.
Yeah, so it's always good. And so I thought I'd start close to where I was and went to a civic association meeting and immediately was kind of identified as someone who could be useful for the neighborhood by the residents at that meeting.
Given your skill set?
I guess.
Or your personality.
Just the new person on the block. Ooh, she doesn't know yet. Let's get her. So I was kind of roped into getting involved in the Civic Association and was actually the Civic Association president. And I had never done anything like that before. I'm pretty introverted and not standoffish, but private.
Yeah.
So I got involved in the Civic Association, got to meet my neighbors, was fascinated by the history of the neighborhood. And along the way, the neighborhood was identified by Virginia Lisk for their Neighborhoods Rising program. And out of that came Greater Fulton's Future. And it was a multi-year, really bottoms-up planning effort funded by Virginia Lisk, brought in a facilitator with a neighborhood resource center. For 2 years, Jason Sawyer really brought the neighborhood together, the residents, black, white, wealthy, not wealthy, everybody. And we worked out what we could do for this neighborhood, these three neighborhoods.
What we could do, who we want to be.
We want to be, what are the issues, what are the projects we can identify to work on in the future. So this effort was called Greater Fulton's Future, ended up with a really nice report that identified all these projects in different categories: there's housing, infrastructure, education, services, the environment, transportation. It was really, for me as an urban planner, it was humbling to let the system just work and not come in as an expert.
Yeah, you could be a participant rather than
And I had to way back off because people looked at me for my expertise, but I was just a resident. And that was really important for me to learn to let that play out.
Yeah, and I'm interested when you talk about the issues, particularly working with such a cross-section of people, old, young, rich, poor, black, white, that there's the expertise side of your world, but there's also just your being a neighbor and getting to know, I don't know, a lady that's lived there for decades. What were some of the issues that you identified? Are there any memories that stuck with you or stories that you heard about the history and the memory of Fulton?
Yeah, about Fulton for sure. I had known a little bit about Fulton. If you go down there now, there's it's a neighborhood of very kind of blah suburban looking houses that were built in the 80s and 90s. The pictures I've seen, the photographs I've seen of the old Fulton, it was a very vibrant neighborhood. It was older than Churchill. It was the oldest part of Richmond. It was the birthplace of Richmond. And over the decades, it had become run down and had some flooding, some serious flooding. Hurricane Camille was, and was the one in 72. So Hurricane Camille and I can't remember the name of the other hurricane. 69 and 72, there were some devastating hurricanes that actually resulted in some fatalities. And that combined with the policies of urban renewal in the 60s and 70s, the riots from 68 and the fear that spread because of those. We wouldn't do that now. We wouldn't just erase a whole neighborhood, but that's what they did back then.
And it was basically razed.
It was completely erased. The streets, the houses were taken down. The streets were erased. There's not even the same street grid anymore. Everything was gone.
And that was in the 70s?
Yeah.
When that happened?
And there are some really wonderful stories of people who went through that and who lived there. And they're documented in the Valentine Has Oral History Project, which is fascinating and wonderful. I encourage anyone to go over and listen to it. And you can listen online, too, to hear the people talk about what a close-knit community it was that had everything they needed. And grocery stores, schools, dry cleaners, churches, real community, multi-generations of families. So yes, a lot of the residents may have been poor, but that doesn't mean that it needed to be erased. So that was fascinating to learn, heartfelt to hear the actual people who went through it. So a lot of times we learn about these things, it's very abstract. Like, yeah, that happened, but there's no personal connection. But to actually talk to the people, you realize how it must feel to lose where generations of your family lived and not even be able to go back and visit. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
One woman, Reverend Mary Perez, had made a quilt of, it was like a map in quilt form of Old Fulton.
Oh, wow.
And it's beautiful. And it's fascinating. It's one of the only maps I've seen. And she'll sit and tell you who lives where, whose aunt lived there and where she went and where she went to church, where she went to school. It's really great. And the Greater Fulton's Future thing, what brought a lot of that out, brought people out who had kind of given up and telling their stories and really opened up those stories again, which was good. It was hard to hear them. I'm sure hard to tell them, but also very cathartic to talk about that.
I think sometimes there's healing that can happen just by being heard or even just asking.
And that, to get back to your point about being a professional urban planner in this whole process, I just had to take that hat off and just listen to people, because it was their community. I have lived in this neighborhood now longer than I've lived anywhere in my whole life, because I've moved around a lot. So to me, it's become home, but it's not. I'm still a newcomer there for the people who have lived there for a long time.
So there you are. You're in Greater Fulton. You're working on this plan, and at some point, you start to hear whisperings of this brewery. Can you just tell me the story about how Stone came to Greater Fulton?
Well, Greater Fulton's Future had been concluded for a couple years before Stone was ever mentioned. And, you know, of all the ideas that the residents had to improve their community, a big brewery from California was not on the list.
Right.
So I heard about Stone, the possibility of Stone coming to the neighborhood, just like everyone else did. I think it was in August of 2014. There was some announcement, some inkling that this brewery from California was looking to locate its East Coast operations in Richmond and in Fulton and at that site.
Was that well received?
Well, we were very curious about it. My personal first reaction was, have they been here? Is this true? Because I'm not seeing it. It didn't seem real. So the community came together. We convened since the Greater Fulton's Future had gotten everyone to kind of know each other, we were able to easily convene a community meeting about this possibility of a brewery. And at that point, Columbus, Ohio, Norfolk, and Richmond were the three finalist cities. Then we found online the RFP, Request for Proposals, that Stone sent out to something like 300 cities. And it's this beautiful document. So we found it. We convened this meeting, had a panel of residents from Greater Fulton to talk about what this might mean and to get the neighbors, the residents' questions and concerns. And, you know, we thought it might mean jobs. We thought it might mean noise. Thought it might mean smells. We thought it might mean traffic and trucks. But we weren't sure. So we just wanted to get a list of what it might mean. We were very curious as we went into it with a spirit of curiosity, not a spirit of you're not coming in here. A lot of times neighborhoods, when they're faced with some sort of change or development, automatically a contingent or maybe the whole neighborhood comes in with a feeling of being against it from the get-go without knowing anything.
It can be adversarial.
Very adversarial.
And in some places, particularly in Richmond, rightfully so, I think there's something, like if in a parallel reality there was an adversarial relationship between the community and these folks coming in, it would make sense because at one point they raised a lot of the city, so that would make sense. But it sounds like you all were able to come together because of the relationships that you had already built.
Yeah.
Said, okay, let's look at this with clear eyes. Let's be open. Here are some things that it could bring. Here are some things that we're worried about. How do we move forward and work with rather than just say we're going to butt heads?
Yeah, we just decided to approach it collaboratively and ask questions and invite them to our Civic Association meeting, invite them to our neighborhood. And they came. I mean, the executive team from Stone came to our Civic Association meeting. They listened to us. It was, you know, really surprising.
And why, as they were looking at Norfolk, Columbus, and Richmond, what made Stone select Richmond?
Well, on the, in the big picture, we're right on 95 and 64. And the whole reason for establishing this East Coast brewery is to make beer that can be distributed up and down the East Coast.
Right.
East of the Rockies. So having 64 was important too. Another important thing for Stone, wherever they ended up, they wanted to be able to make a difference. And that's really why they chose this particular section of Richmond. At the time, Ohio had a state law limiting the alcohol levels in for breweries, for beer. I don't recall what the alcohol content was. It was high. It was like 14%. But occasionally, Stone makes stronger beers in their pilot systems. Right. So that was one factor, I believe, in Ohio. And I was not part of that whole, I was not with Stone at that point. Norfolk, they really liked the Norfolk site. I don't know why Norfolk wasn't chosen. It may have been the size of the site. At one point, they were also looking at Roanoke. They really liked Roanoke, but I believe the site size was too small.
Right.
And they had originally actually looked at a site in Manchester across the river. But it wasn't big enough. So the city said, well, we've got this other piece of property across the river. You might want to take a look at it. And that turned out to be what they really liked.
And here we are.
And
how did you go from interested, engaged community member to Stone employee?
Well, I was interested, engaged community member for a long time. Worked with other interested, engaged community members. We decided to have a public community event. Actually, it was before Stone announced, so to kind of draw them, let them know that we wanted them here. The other two cities, Columbus and Norfolk, had come up with some videos to attract Stone.
Always good.
Always good, although I will say that they were of the, I call them 3B type of videos, the babes in bikinis having a beer on a beach, the 4Bs. And
what's up, Stone? We're in Norfolk. You want to come here?
That's right. And that's fine. That's cool. Right.
It works for some. Yeah.
That's okay. it wasn't us. But we looked around and said, well, Richmond hasn't done any video. So we decided as a community, we would come together, have this public art event. And we got Paul DePasquale involved. He's a resident of Fulton Hill. Corey Lane from the Martin Agency has some great ideas. So a whole bunch of residents came together and decided to do this thing. Yeah, and we got permission from the city to use the corner of Nicholson Street and Williamsburg Avenue, where Stone sits now. Paul DePasquale had come up with this design. We used stones and straw from Southern States and made this basically a giant beer mug on the ground. We also had stones where people could write or paint their messages on the stones. We got a DJ came out and donated his services. So it was kind of like a a party.
Had they already made the decision, or this was the effort to convince them?
We had done all this planning for this event before they'd made the decision. And 10 days before our planned event, they made the decision.
Oh, okay.
So instead of a come to Richmond celebration, it was like welcome. We called it Welcome Home Stone.
Oh, that's great.
We took pictures and someone in
I'm guessing fewer women in bikinis as well.
There's no babes in bikinis and actually no bottles of beer.
Just people.
Just people and this giant mug of beer. Just people. We took pictures and someone said, well, we need to make a video of this. We didn't have any money, so we couldn't hire a videographer. So I said, well, I got this new iPad. It has this iMovie app. I'll just try it. So I ended up making this little video, put it on YouTube. I've never made a YouTube video before or since, but it caught the attention of Greg Cook, who's at the time the CEO and co-founder of Stone, and made Stone, you know, feel really good about their decision. And then once Stone had chosen Richmond, and Richmond was all patting themselves on the back, yay, yay, everyone was really happy. Then the real work began, because there were 14 different papers that had to be approved by City Council about the financing and the funding. So once the glow wore off,
the work begins.
Yeah, the work begins, and there were some voices who did not like this idea, who may have really liked the idea of Stone coming, but didn't like the idea of the financing. But we collectively, a core group of us really went to every single city council meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I know I spoke at every city council meeting saying this is an investment in this community that the city had divested itself from for 40 years, had destroyed a neighborhood and had not reinvested in it. And this is our chance to bring some sparkle back to this community and reinvestment and more interest. So we went through that whole process, and it was all over. Everything was approved. It wasn't easy to get it approved, but it was approved. And Greg Cook, the CEO of Stone, was at that last meeting, and I hadn't met him, and he came up to me and said, oh, Julie Ellen, I thank you so much. I saw your video. It's so great. Come have a beer with us. And I was tired and hungry and probably fighting a flu. And I just said, no, you don't need me anymore. That's cool.
I've done my work. Yeah.
I'm going home, going to sleep. So I got home and realized, like, all right, Greg Cook just asked you to go for a beer. So you should really go for a beer. So I turned around and went back. And it was kind of a celebratory evening at Southern Railway Tap House right down the the street, and it was great. But I uncharacteristically, usually I'm pretty shy, but I just said, hey, you know, I know my job is done here, but if you ever need anything, let me know. I didn't ask him for a job, but I said, you know, if you ever need any help, let me know. I'm here. So a couple weeks later, the COO of Stone, Pat Tiernan, called me and said, hey, yeah, that thing you were talking to Greg about, let's talk about that. So the timing worked out. So I worked part-time for them from May 2015 to February of 2016, and then I started working full-time in February of 2016.
Wow. What a great story of going from the interested, engaged citizen to now being able to take part in actually building and revitalizing as a part of your 9-to-5.
Yeah, and you know, community relations managers tend to plan events, go to meetings, usually are in marketing departments, but I'm not in the marketing department at Stone. I'm in the operations department of the Richmond Brewery. Our marketing department is in California, and I work closely with them, but I'm not under them. I don't consider myself a marketing person.
You got your work boots on right now.
I got my work boots on.
So you're probably out and about.
Yep. And I don't consider myself a spin person. I think public relations tends to have that connotation, and I'm very aware of that because it's kind of how I feel what PR is. Because of my background in planning and landscape architecture, I've also taken it upon myself to manage the grounds. We have 14 acres at the brewery with a creek Gillies Creek that runs through it.
And you manage that.
Yeah, I don't cut the grass myself.
Right.
But we're working with Groundwork RVA,
mm-hmm.
Which is a local nonprofit that engages city youth with environmental education and job training and landscape.
Is that with Giles Harnsberger over there?
Giles is the director.
So will you just kind of walk out and be like, oh, we should put some, we could do some grass or some trees.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's like I do the gardening myself in the on the terrace. And I help choose the trees. We want native plants. We want a meadow, low maintenance. We've settled on Groundwork RVA because it's such a great community organization. We want, you know, we pay them to take care of our grounds. They pay the kids on their green team. We're also offering all of our land as a kind of a environmental laboratory. And I have a background in landscape architecture, and I'm certified Chesapeake Bay landscape professional. So I know about native plants and bioretention basins and stormwater management. So I can help Giles and our Groundwork teach the kids about that. So
how gratifying is that for you?
It's
like,
awesome.
I feel like that's gotta be, cause what I'm hearing is there's a value in people and relationships. And like you said, I'm not a PR person. I'm not a marketing person, but it sounds like you're a people person. On some level, I mean, I know that it sounds like you're an introvert, but also being able to draw from your expertise and your background where you kind of have this palette of like, well, we can kind of make this what we want it to be. Do you guys want to come help?
Yeah.
I think that's a really unique.
That's great. And Stone has been amazing in letting me do that. I kind of say, well, this is what I want to do. And they say, hey, go for it.
All right. Sounds great.
And just, in fact, it's just amazing. And I wake up and I say, I can't believe I get to do this stuff.
Yeah. I want to loop back around and ask you about the financial structure because I think there's been some pushback. I think particularly early on and even since, you know, last year there were some articles that were coming out. And essentially, one of the issues is that the city provided some economic incentives to attract Stone here. Not totally abnormal. I think it was $31 million in bond funding to basically finance and oversee the construction of the brewery and then the restaurant that will come to the riverfront. And Stone would basically repay that over 25 years in rent. But there was some pushback, especially from folks in the restaurant community, basically saying that the city is using public funds or they're picking winners. So that was one issue. And then there's been some other stuff more recently of saying, hey, there have been cheaper deals that have been done in Roanoke and other places to attract breweries. How do you respond to kind of those two criticisms? One just about we're picking winners and the other one about we could have gotten a better deal.
Well, first thing I want to say is that there's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about how basic economic development works. And that's to be expected. I mean, economic development is not really simple. It's always very complex. But the perception and what people say is that we gave Stone $33 million, $31 million. A lot of people think that their city wrote a check.
Right. Here's a bag of cash, Stone.
$31 million.
Right.
That is absolutely not true.
Right.
The state wrote a check for $5 million. The city wrote a check for a smaller amount.
I think it was like two.
Two. Yeah. I think it was $2 million. One or $2 million. I should check that.
Yeah.
as a grant. The bond money, bonds are raised for economic development projects all the time. All over the country. Bonds have to be repaid with interest. And the big argument that we hear is that why couldn't we use that money on schools? If anyone knows how to make schools profitable to pay back the money that is owed on the bonds, which is the bond money plus interest, that's awesome. Tell
right.
us. Tell whoever needs to know about that. Some cities do use bond money for schools, but they have enough property taxes or other income to pay back that money. Richmond does not, so they could not have used that money for schools. They would have defaulted on the bonds, and then everyone would have been screwed.
Right.
So that's not to say that the schools don't need help. They absolutely do. But this money did not take anything away from the schools.
Yeah, and I think that those two things aren't mutually exclusive when we think about economic development and also we need to mow the grass and we need to fix the ceiling tiles in schools. Those are very important things, but the ways that we get money for some of those things is by getting tax money flowing in.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that if you rewind, we only have 62 miles to develop in the city.
Right.
There was this unused city land. It was basically a brown field, and now it's going to be producing income. That's good.
It's going to be producing income. It's created jobs. It also is it's almost like an incubator, or it's not an incubator, but it has sparked additional redevelopment of that whole area, which is great. And what I said back at the time when this was all being discussed is that any restaurant that wanted to develop in that neighborhood would have been welcome to come. And I believe it was Charles Samuels pointed out there are 11 different economic development programs for anyone to come and develop in that neighborhood. And Stone is the one who took advantage of that. No one else in the city did. So to the restaurant community who said, why is the city giving this company money? There's money for them to come over there too if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And the community would welcome them. So I don't buy that argument.
Yeah. And I think I read that the total lease payments over the life of the lease will be $60 million. Essentially, the net income for the city more than covers the cost over 25 years. It's a longer term play.
Right.
All right. Wonky financial stuff covered. I want to ask about your collaboration beers. Let's talk beer. We're talking beer. You've collaborated on two beers with Hardywood and Ardent. The first was Give Me Stout or Give Me Death, right?
Yep.
And what was the most recent one?
Give Me IPA or Give Me Death.
Uh-huh. How did that come about? Because it seems like if you guys are the big boy on the block, you could just come in and crush these little guys. Why didn't you do that? Why collaborate?
Well, the craft beer industry doesn't do that. There's collaborations going on all the time between little breweries and bigger breweries in the craft industry. Now, larger macro breweries will come and crush, but we don't. We've collaborated with Ardent on other stuff and with Triple Crossing.
Mm-hmm.
We collaborated with them. So the Give Me Stout or Give Me Death and the Give Me IPA or Give Me Death, the idea came from Governor McAuliffe in Philadelphia at a conference last year.
Oh.
He wanted a beer using Virginia ingredients. So we said, sure, let's bring in some local breweries. So we've worked with Ardent a lot, Hardywood as well. So we wanted to use as many Virginia ingredients as we could. And they came up with this idea for a recipe. The fabulous thing about craft beer is that it's like, yeah, let's try this. Okay, yeah, let's try it. And then you've got a recipe, you go try a pilot batch, and it turns out okay. You make some adjustments, and boom, you have an actual beer. It's pretty quick.
That's awesome.
So the Give Me Stout or Give Me IPA was the first one. It was released in December. And it's a collaboration, as you said, between Governor McAuliffe, Stone, Ardent, and Hardywood. And it used blackberries and raspberries from Agriberry in Hanover County. The stout used some malt from Copper Fox, which is up near Culpeper. Hops from Piedmont Hops and Huguenot Hops, which is in this region. And then the other ingredients are yeast and water. So it turned out great. Both beers are fantastic. Give Me IPA's out now. And Give Me IPA is national distribution. So it's getting Ardent and Hardywood a national audience that they so far hadn't had.
Hmm.
So that's another advantage for collaborating with a larger craft brewery. Yeah.
You can share your platform a little
bit. Well, in fact, the governor was in San Francisco last week and wanted some of this beer for his event in San Francisco. So we scrambled and we got him a couple cases of Give Me IPA or Give Me Death. And he, of course, held it up. And
Virginia!
Virginia is the greatest state.
Let me tell you about all the ingredients. Yeah.
And so that got apparently great coverage out in California.
He's like the beer governor.
He is the beer governor. But yeah, we collaborate. Next month's collaboration is going to be with Triple Crossing and the Neighborhood Resource Center of Fulton Hill, of Fulton.
And Triple Crossing now has a location in Fulton,
right? Yeah, they expanded to Fulton.
You guys are neighbors.
We're neighbors. They saw us there and said, "Hey, let's get in while the getting's good." And we're delighted to have them. And they have a pizza oven, so that's fabulous.
Jackpot. Never hurts to have a pizza.
We all go over
oven.
There for pizza right. and good beer.
Is the Richmond region oversaturated with breweries? Are there any signs of that?
I don't think so. Asheville's a much smaller city, and it has a lot more breweries. San Diego has a lot more breweries. Of course, it's bigger. But no, I think proportion-wise, it's not nearly saturated yet.
People love their beer.
And on Saturday, we had our one-year anniversary party this past Saturday. It was packed. I heard the Vale was packed. I heard Ardent was packed.
Yeah.
Triple Crossing was packed. So there's no shortage of people who in Richmond, in the Richmond region, and who travel to Richmond for beer. There's no shortage of them. The demand is there.
The
demand is huge.
Is what you're saying. I want to ask you about the restaurant that's coming. It will be the World Bistro and Gardens.
Stone World Bistro and Gardens.
And geographically, basically, it will be on the river. So if you know where Rocket's Landing is, it'll be just towards the city, around the intermediate terminal and the sugar pad. I know that there are a couple. There's another location in California. Mm-hmm. And is there one coming in Berlin as well?
Yeah, the Berlin, Stone developed a brewery in Berlin at the same time they were developing the Richmond Brewery.
Mm-hmm.
The Berlin Brewery is a smaller brewery, but it also has a restaurant. And they're open. They're operational. They're making and distributing beer to 19 European countries.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were the first American-owned craft brewery to do that.
Well, that makes sense because I've always said that Richmond is the Berlin of America.
Well, there you go. I have not yet been to Berlin, right. So I can't.
Yeah, judge. Can you describe the vision of what that Bistro and Gardens will be on the river that's just a walking distance from the brewery itself?
It will be
Paint the picture for me. The
Intermediate Terminal Building. It will be the Intermediate Terminal Building, which is a 1937 warehouse. And it's the building you drive underneath on Dock Street, which is actually Water Street right there.
Right.
It's going to be pretty neat. It's farm-to-table restaurant. Very, very good food. Try to source as many ingredients locally as we can. In Escondido, California, now I'm an East Coast person. Raised my whole life, lived on the East Coast. Went to Escondido. And all my Escondido colleagues and friends forgive me to say this, but there's not a whole lot in Escondido to go to, except for Stone, in my opinion.
Right.
It's good hiking. It's in the mountains. It's East North County, San Diego. It's beautiful, but it's not a destination in and of itself. And yet, people make that drive to Escondido to go to Stone, and it has brought people to Escondido who otherwise wouldn't have gone there. Stone Brewing and Stone World Bistro and Gardens in Escondido is the third biggest tourist attraction in San Diego County.
Wow.
After Legoland, and there's a zoo wilderness park.
And Stone is the third.
And it's not like downtown San Diego. You have to want to get there.
What makes it so great? Why is it such a draw?
It's this oasis in the desert. It's amazing food, amazing beer. It's really this amazing experience that isn't in very many places. And it ought to be. It's, you know, whole foods, real beer made by real people. And to just relax, there's no TVs. Stone does not have TVs. If you come to Stone, we want you to sit and have a conversation.
Talk to a person.
Beer. Yeah. But it's excellent food, amazing experience, you know, slow food. Take your time, appreciate your company and the ingredients, and conversation. That's really what it's all about.
Yeah. So will that same vibe, because you'll have the restaurant and then the sugar pad and kind of that patch of land, that will all be the gardens and the Richmond location?
The city is right now working with Stone to get the site planning all done. Mm-hmm. But the city is will have parks all along the river. Oh. So stone will be incorporated into that. The restaurant will be renovated. The building will be renovated. We'll have the gardens as well, beer garden. It'll be a fantastic experience right on the river. You'll be able to see the river, the sunsets. So it's going to be fabulous. Virginia Capitol Trail is mm-hmm. going to be right there. It's going to be great.
Do you have a sense of time-wise when that will be a reality?
Looking at late 2018, possibly early of 2019.
Okay. I can wait. I'm a patient man.
My stomach's growling now. I'm probably more patient than I am.
You painted the picture too vivid.
I know.
I just want to eat all that great food.
It's going to be more of a draw to get more people to come to Richmond, who then will go check out other breweries and restaurants.
Come on down. It's great. Mm-hmm. Final question for you. As you look back as a Fulton advocate and Richmond resident now, what does the success of Stone and the ways that it's thinking about growing, what does that mean to you?
For me personally, the fact that Stone, one, hired someone from that community, me, says a lot about their philosophy. That they really do mean what they say when they say they want to make a difference in the mm-hmm. community. They could have shipped out a PR person from California or not had anyone or hired someone from another part of town.
Right.
They also are allowing me to do what I want to do in terms of the grounds maintenance. I would love for Stone to be a model of more sustainable corporate grounds maintenance. Mm-hmm. Stone is already, it's a LEED Silver certified building, which is a really big deal for a manufacturing plant. So if we can lead the way by example in terms of sustainability, that's fabulous. And for me, sustainability includes community, not just the natural environment.
What do you mean by that?
This gets back to my urban planning mm-hmm. master's thesis, but my ideas, there are five ingredients for sustainability, and that is the natural environment, of course, economics, the social scene, the mm-hmm. social part, mm-hmm. the culture, and the aesthetics. And all those combined together in different proportions are really required for success of a sustainable development. Those are my thoughts from back in 1999 when I did my master's thesis before sustainable development was a term that was bounced about.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're describing is not just we need these light bulbs to be more efficient.
Right.
But sustainable.
Sustainable economically.
Is broader and it's holistic. Culturally, and what does it mean to sustain socially, life in this place over time with
and
these
what
people.
It looks like is important too. So this is such an amazing and unexpected way for me to learn to make that a reality.
And Richmond will be better for it.
I hope so.
Well, I'm glad you're there.
Thank you.
Julie Ellen, thank you so much.
Come over for a tour sometime. And once the spring meadows start blooming, we'll come and do a wildflower tour.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
That'd be cool.
Great. Julie Ellen Sarver, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been a real pleasure.
It's been fun.
You can pick up a 6-pack of some Stone beer at your local grocery store, or you can stop by the tasting room over at Stone, check out the landscape, drink a beer with your face. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or other podcast places. Our theme is by No BS Brass. Chris Payne is the feeling you get after your mom gives you some old boxes from high school and you get them all cleaned out and it feels awesome. That's Chris. Thanks for listening.